In this episode of Cube FM, we're joined by Amos Winger, developer, writer, and the protagonist of one of the most chaotic and deeply educational Kubernetes stories hit the internet recently. Their article titled, More DevOps Than I Bargained For. In that piece, and in today's conversation, Amos walks us through how a seemingly harmless decision to add a home computer as a Kubernetes node turned into a full-blown production incident. TLS certificates failing to renew, cert manager challenges timing out, pods becoming unreachable depending on where they scheduled, unexpected NAP behavior in both IPv4 and IPv6, Kubernetes overlay networks performing translation they never asked for, CNI plugins behaving in ways only ancient documentation vaguely hinted at, and all the bizarre consequences of mixing cloud VMs with a node sitting behind a consumer router. In this episode, we'll break down, step by step, the root causes behind the outage, what actually happens when Cert Manager lands on the wrong node, how Kubernetes networking model masks critical differences between environments, and why Calico, Flannel, and IPv6, NAT66 all collided to create a problem you simply can't reproduce in a normal cluster. If you care about cluster networking, if you ever wondered what happens when you blend cloud infrastructure with home lab hardware, or if you enjoy watching Kubernetes expose every assumption you didn't know you were making, this episode is definitely for you. This episode of Cube FM is sponsored by LearnCube. Since 2017, LearnCube has provided trainings to Kubernetes engineers all over the world. Courses are instructor-led and are 60% practical and 40% theoretical. They are given both online and in person to individuals as well as to groups. Students have access to the course materials for the rest of their lives. For more information, check out learncube.com. Now, let's get into the episode. Welcome to Cube FM. What are three emerging Kubernetes tools that you're keeping an eye on?
This is a tough one. I initially didn't want to answer that question, and then I've been doing a ton of Kubernetes stuff since. So now I'm keeping my eyes on a lot of things. The problem is I don't know which one are emerging and which one have been around for a long time, because I'm just like discovering everything fresh. You know, everything is new to me. If I had to pick three, Argo's not emerging, is it? Argo's been around for a while.
It's been around for a while, but yeah. There's a strong community behind it in the GitOps world. Yeah.
For me, it's new. It's emerging in my mind. And Argo City is like a game changer in terms of just clicking around. Before that, it was K9S. K9S was another game changer. So we went from like, you know, kubectl in the console to like K9S with UI and then Argo City. Does anything else come to mind? I'm keeping an eye on like my own SSO software because I've tried the options that we have right now. I tried Keycloak. I tried the one that starts with Z that I forgot. And I'm not happy with any other options, Bart. I think I'm going to come up with my own because for UI reasons and tech stacks reasons and, you know, so I'm keeping an eye on my own stuff, I guess.
Okay. Sounds like there's an opportunity there for growth. In terms of what you do and who you work for, can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I work for myself. I'm lucky that I got fired about like a year and a half, 2 years ago, and I had enough patrons, enough sponsors on GitHub and Patreon to just go like, well, I have been writing articles, producing videos about Rust since 2019. I've been doing it like more and more seriously, and the job ended, and I was like, I guess I don't need to look for another job. I guess I can just keep doing that. It was kind of like I have money on the side. We'll see if the revenue increases and it's sustainable in the long term. And so far, it has been so.
Fantastic. And how did you get into cloud native? What's the story behind that?
I guess we would have to define cloud native. Like I was just talking about Kubernetes. Like I said, like I have tremendous imposter syndrome coming into this podcast. I was very nervous when you initially reached out. And I was like, there's a bunch of buzzwords. I'm constantly Googling things. I'm like, oh, that's what they mean. It's not scary when you know what it means. So like cloud native, I know the foundation. I know like is what exactly? How would you define it exactly?
How do I define cloud native? Cloud native means designing and running applications that automatically scale, heal, and evolve by leveraging containers, orchestration, and modern distributed infrastructure. At least that's the official definition. What about you?
Okay, so there is a clear answer then. I just don't want to say the name of the employer, and I don't remember the year, but essentially we had this monstrous Ansible playbook to deploy a reverse proxy at the edge on a bunch of edge nodes. And a colleague of mine who was more senior in these things pushed for using K3S instead. Like on every edge node, have a K3S cluster. I use Spinnaker to do rollouts, you know. And I don't think I was very attracted to it initially. I think I was resistant to it, like much of the team. But over time, I think I was convinced enough that when it came time for me to maintain my own infrastructure, like have a website, because story of my website is like, oh, it's a static website. It's Hugo, right? And then it's like, oh, I just need login. I just need to like some articles or early access. And, oh, I just need like a full text search engine that runs on the server because all the client sides are bad. And like suddenly you're like, okay, I'm maintaining a server. And I was like, okay, let's try this K3S thing. I guess it can't be that bad. And I've been like, it's been downhill from there. I don't know, it's like more and deeper and deeper into the whole Kubernetes thing. And now I'm like super into it, to the point that I was looking at like some vendor offering, or like you get containers all around the globe. They scale to zero. You pay almost nothing. We do everything for you. We do like Terminate TLS and everything. And I was like, this sounds super cool, and it would definitely cost less than what I have right now, but I don't want it. Like I just my cluster is too comfortable. I know how to do observability. I know how to do everything. I don't want it.
And, you know, the Kubernetes and cloud native ecosystem, it moves very, very quickly and is often a challenge for a lot of people to stay on top of all the changes, to stay up to date. Some people prefer blogs, some people prefer videos, some people prefer podcasts. What works best for you?
I'm going to confess something in this podcast. ChatGPT worked really, really well. So here's the thing about ChatGPT, okay? Everybody hates it. I'm ashamed to admit it. It was really bad, and then it got the ability to actually search for things. So if you get a sense that it's an adversarial conversation, like sometimes it just makes things up, and you just have to say that sounds wrong, and then you're like, do more research, and you can learn. Like it's not a source of truth for sure, but it's a great kind of fuzzy search when you don't know what you should know. You're like, just it helps you learn the vocabulary, the language of what you should be looking at. And then you can actually find primary sources, like just documentations and code. I don't actually read a lot of blogs, just because I write mine and I don't know. I just don't like to. And documentation I find often to be lacking. So I end up reading a lot of source code directly, actually, just to figure out how things work, which is a thing you can do, you know, in the whole open source ecosystem. You're hearing my cat, by the way. His name is Sherlock. He's white and wonderful. He's featured in some of my videos sometimes.
Great. Very good. Welcome, Sherlock. This is the first time I think we're having a cat. We've done about 80 really? Episodes. This is the first one featuring a cat, so it's very exciting.
You need better get... I'm kidding. You need guests. Guests who don't lock up their cats for the recording.
Now, you know, another thing, like you mentioned about how you decided to take the steps that you've taken, you know, in your career path, and also, you know, the financing regarding that. But if you could go back in time and share one career tip with your younger self, what would it be?
I made the mistake several times in a row, because it takes me a while to learn, to like just get friendly with your boss in a small company, and then have that kind of relationship where they, you know, you think they're your friend, because we're friendly, because it's a small company, because it's like, you know, there's not a lot of bureaucracy, there's not a lot of... And I kind of regret letting those, like not recognizing the power dynamics there, and kind of letting them get advantage of me, and like, in a way that they were like, oh, can't you work a little bit more? Like, or like them taking advantage of the fact that I just really like to work a lot. They didn't stop me. They were like, oh, great, more work for that same salary. So... there were definitely some shady things there. It was a long time ago. Like, I'm not nervous about anyone recognizing themselves there. But I guess the advice would be like, a job is a job. Even if you like your colleagues, you like your bosses, HR is not on your side. Your boss is not like, it's a job. Like, and now that I work for myself, especially, I'm like, oh, this is different, right? When I work a lot, it's for myself. I'm like, I'm building something for myself. But if you're building something for someone else, you know, count your hours, clock out, go have a life. That would be my advice.
Very good. Sound advice. As a freelancer, I strongly agree. And I think a lot of people need to hear that at the end of the day, you have to understand, you know, mechanisms that you're a part of. This is about making money, and you should be very transparent about that. Of course, you can have friendships at work, and you can have positive relationships, and ones based on trust and support, respect, caring for each other, and all those other things. But it's also really important to keep in mind what this is about. And just to be honest about that. And I think we can all have more adult conversations with each other and be even, if we really want to be respectful of each other, is to keep those things in mind too. So I think that's very sound advice. We'll definitely link the video in the show notes. Now, we're here today to talk with you about an article that you wrote titled "More DevOps Than I Bargained For." So we want to take a look at this more in detail. But before we get too into the specific incident that you mentioned in the article, can you give us some background on your Kubernetes setup and what led to adding a home computer as a node to your production cluster?
So it's pretty simple, really. I had a bunch of Edge. So I built my own CDN, essentially, but not the fun way, not Anycast, just GeoDNS, as far as this article is concerned. So I had a bunch of Hetzner Cloud VM, small ones, in different regions. And they started offering ARM64. And back then, I was looking to be cost efficient. And ARM64 ones were like slightly cheaper. And I was like, oh, what a good time to try and build all my applications for both ARM64 and AMD64. But unfortunately, like, I didn't have any large enough CI runners for this to do both. So I migrated a bunch of things to ARM64, and I was like, I still need to do x86 because it's in some regions, Hetzner doesn't have ARM64 instances. They don't have them in, like, the US and Singapore, I think. And so I still needed a big x86 runner to get everything working. Also, because I'm an idiot, I realized that after migrating. So, like, some services were down, and suddenly I needed an x86 image of my software. And I figured I have a Mac Studio at home that's on 24/7 because it's running some other home things. And I was like, well, I could just make a VM. I could just run UTM or whatever lets me run an x86 VM on my Mac Studio and have it join the cluster. Seems simple enough, really.
All right. So you added this home computer to your cluster, and initially everything seemed fine. But what was the first sign that something was wrong, and how did it manifest?
Well, the TLS certificate stuff renewing. I noticed that, like, some domains were wrong, some certificate expired and didn't renew. And the way it would normally work is you have Cert Manager. I don't know if there's other solutions to that in Kubernetes, but that's what I landed on. You have Cert Manager, and it's using the HTTP endpoints. It's generating a challenge. I don't know how the whole exact flow works, but, like, it's creating an endpoint that gets mounted at, like, dash dot well known something something with a secret, and there's, like, the Let's Encrypt servers that hit your server to verify that you actually own the domain name. That's one of the types of challenges that you can do. The rest of the article really wouldn't exist if I just figured out that you could do DNS challenges instead, which I switched to yesterday.
And when these certificate renewals started failing, how did you narrow the problem down to the home node specifically?
Well, I used K9S to look into where the challenge pods were running, and the ones that ran on the cloud VMs were working, and the one that ran on the home node were failing. Because I didn't really... You can specify, you know, you can specify node selectors, you can specify tolerations. There's a bunch of ways to control where pods get scheduled, and I guess I didn't lock down well enough what could get scheduled on the home node. I could have tainted it in some way, and then I wouldn't have had this problem. I could have... There's so many different ways I could have prevented this from happening. But the point is, it was kind of a free-for-all, and the scheduler saw some free compute, some free resources, and was like, yeah, sure, why not put the challenge over there?
All right. Now, let's talk a little bit more about why the home node was different. Your cloud VMs have public IP addresses, but your home computer sits behind your router. How did this difference in network setup cause problems?
Well, it's quite simple, really. I also have a video about this. Called I've just had three coffees and I'm going to explain to you how the internet works or something like that. And the problem is that we don't have enough IPv4 addresses, so we're kind of cheating by, well, we don't have enough IPv4 addresses for all the internet-enabled devices on Earth. So all the devices in my house are sharing one public IPv4 address, and it works in one direction. My node was able to, like, my Mac Studio, the VM in my Mac Studio was able to go and join the cluster. But when Let's Encrypt came knocking to try and validate the challenge, then it couldn't. because it hits the router and the router is like, I'm not expecting a call on this port. Goodbye. And that's it.
So you started debugging this network path issue. And in the process, what tools did you use to understand how the traffic was actually flowing?
So my go-to is, of course, K9S, where you can see nodes, you can see their IP addresses, you can get information about the pods and everything, but that's not enough. Even though it lets you shell into an existing pod, I tend to have slim images that don't even have curls. So what you want to have is a debug pod next to that. And that's where NetShooter comes in. NetShooter is just the namespace, actually. It's Nikoraka NetShoot, yeah, which has curl and a bunch of other network tools, and that's where you can see what the traffic is actually doing. So from there, mostly, you know, IP adder, like, which is from IP2 tools. Yeah, we don't use ifconfig anymore. This isn't macOS. And then traceroute, of course, traceroute was not actually that helpful. And then just curl, yeah, just curl it and see where it goes.
And at this point, you discovered that your cluster was doing something called NAT, or network address translation, for both IPv4 and IPv6. Can you explain what was happening with the network traffic?
So what I expected was, because I have real IPv6, I have like IPv6 support, my home internet service provider gives me an IPv6 prefix. So what I expected would happen was, for IPv6 at least, that the VM would have its own IP address taken from that prefix, and it would be publicly routable, so reachable from the outside and everything. However, this is not how it works for IPv6 for sure. And for IPv4, what ended up happening is that the node's address was not taken from the CIDR range that I configured for my nodes. It was taken from the LAN net. Like, it was 192.168.0.100 or something, instead of being from in the 10.x range.
Now, this IPv6 behavior surprised you because your home internet has real IPv6 addresses. Why was the cluster still translating these addresses?
Kubernetes does use an overlay network. The addresses of the pods are not necessarily public, and they're just used to, like, so the pods can talk to each other, and it's encrypted in between them and everything, depending on how it's set up, including for IPv6. So that means there's some address translation going on. In the case of this article, which got very confusing, there was also NAT going on inside of the VM hypervisor on macOS. So, like, there were multiple levels of IPv6 translation going on.
You mentioned switching from Flannel to Calico as your network plugin. What drove this decision? Why did you decide to do this? And what's the difference between these CNI plugins if people out there are faced with the same choice?
The main reason was definitely because Calico can handle the IPv6 translation better. So I was hoping to at least fix IPv6 with that. The type of translation it's doing is called NAT66. And I just mentioned that encrypted traffic between nodes, that depends on how your cluster is set up, actually. And Calico definitely does that. It has a WireGuard network that's just transparent. You can see it if you look at the pod logs when it boots up. It's bootstrapping that network, and it's fun to see.
And once you understood the problem, you needed pods on the home node to use the real IPv6 addresses instead of the private overlay addresses. How did you approach solving this?
So is it a Calico thing? You can create different IP pools and decide which nodes pick from which pools, essentially. So you can have private IP addresses for your cloud nodes, and you can have the home node get a real IPv6 address from the prefix of my ISP, I suppose.
You tested your solution and discovered something that was quite odd. The pods were accessible from the internet, but not from your home network. What was going on there?
This is a very fun thing that is called LAN hairpinning, or NTP scope problems. I'm not sure exactly of the details, but it is documented as it has a Wikipedia page, so it exists.
Now, throughout this debugging session, you were working at 4 a.m. with your website down. How do you decide when to push through versus when to roll back and try again later?
I like breaking things just to learn about them and then writing about it so I don't forget too much what happened. But at this point, I hadn't really backed up the old images. It, like, this is a very bad example of ops. If it was for a business, it would have been terrible. Like, we would do a blameless postmortem, but people would blame me silently. But in this case, it was just, it's just me. It's just me for me. People can wait to read articles. It's on archive.org. It's fine. In general, I'd rather roll forward. Probably because I'm an idiot. Probably because I'm cost fallacy, honestly. but also because every time you have a problem like this, it's an opportunity to learn something new. If you just roll back, and then you lose the situation in which you can study. So if it's something that's not too important, you can actually afford the downtime, then it's nice to be able to explore and just learn about a bunch of things. I mean, the main thing I learned is that I never should have added this node, or I should have tainted it, but you know.
And this incident revealed many hidden assumptions about node networking and Kubernetes. What should teams consider when mixing different types of nodes, whether they're cloud, on-premises, or edge?
They don't have all the same network characteristics, for sure. I think I've learned my lesson. I now label my nodes religiously and have very strict node selector directives, I would say. Now I have a whole thing where I have Terraform that brings up the VMs. Then I have a Rust script that reads the Terraform output and generates an inventory. And then I have Ansible that generates a K3S templates config from that. And that assigns all the labels to the node. So I used to have only like node type X, Y, or Z, like edge, control, compute. And now I have like 5 or 6 different labels, which controls what you can do. For example, you can have cloud volumes on Hetzner cloud VMs, but you can't have cloud volumes on a dedicated. So same thing for networking. I think, would I do it again? Yes, especially like if you need a lot of computers, buying a lot of computers can make sense. But I would read this article several times and try to figure out what happens and very, very carefully schedule loads on there and kind of test all the networking. This is not the first time that traceroute has been completely useless because it doesn't actually reflect how packets are routed. I just wanted to sneak that in there because it's traceroute is looks like it's going to solve and explain everything, and it really doesn't.
And looking back, what would you do differently? And what advice would you give to others who might be considering adding home lab resources to their production clusters?
Don't do it. Just make a second cluster.
Anything else?
In retrospect, I kind of took for granted that networking worked. I didn't actually read about it. I'm, believe it or not, and it's not really obvious from this episode, I'm quite knowledgeable in a lot of aspects, but networking was not really one of them. And so I kind of assumed it would just work. I kind of assumed that the surface level knowledge that I had was enough. Where, in fact, when I saw the acronym CNI the first 2 or 3 times, I should have stopped and read about it and like compared the options a lot more than I did.
When we've talked to a lot of folks in the ecosystem about their favorite and least favorite Kubernetes features, when it comes to least favorite Kubernetes features, networking and network policy management are generally at the top. Is that something you would agree with?
Oh, yeah, because I've destroyed 2 clusters that way.
Fair enough. And on the other side, what would be your favorite Kubernetes feature if you had to choose one?
This one's silly, I guess, but like just how easy it is to move loads around. Just cordon, drain, you're done. Like that's pretty cool. I don't know. I just like seeing it. Yeah, like seeing the number of pods drain. It's just kind of neat when it works.
And what's next for you?
I did run the CDN with GeoDNS and like pretty simple networking for a long time. And I'm in the process of learning about Anycast. I'm in the process of getting my own ASN. I'm going to lease some IPv4 address space. I'm going to learn a bunch more acronyms. And I think we all know you can expect some more downtime on my website.
Fair enough. And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Probably go to my YouTube channel, watch something, and then leave a comment. I always read my comments.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining us today on CubeFM. Look forward to speaking to you again in the future. Take care.